Rodgers in trouble. It's going to get there. He turned 32 yesterday. Does he have a vintage moment in it? In the end zone, it is caught for the win. Richard Rodgers with a walk-off touchdown. A game ender for the Packers.
Welcome to the Glass Half Empty podcast. I'm Ryan Glasspiegel. Our guest today is Ira Burko. Ira was a longtime writer for the New York Times. He has a book that was released recently entitled It Happens Every Spring, and it's a big collection of his baseball writing. So Ira, the first entry in the book, you're in Jerry Reinsdorf's box at a White Sox at Nationals game, and Steven Strasburg, he had just come up. This was at the point in his career where it seemed like anything was possible for him. And into the game, President Obama comes in to Reinsdorf's box. You introduce yourself, and he's like, oh, yeah, I've read one of your books. How surreal was that?
Yeah, well, I was in... The White Sox were playing the Nationals in Washington, and Obama is a White Sox fan, and so he was invited by Reinsdorf, the owner of the White Sox, got a complimentary box. They do that for owners and for visiting owners, and so. I was invited, come up from New York, because I knew Reinsdorf and his friend Billy Meravitz, who was a former state senator from Illinois in Chicago. And just before the game starts, this tall black guy, skinny guy, or thin, wearing a White Sox cap, walks in, and it was Obama. And this was in the summer of 2010. And I'm introduced to him. It was a small box with not many people, a handful of people, and I was introduced to him, and he said, you wrote the book with Clyde being Walt Frazier, and anybody who follows basketball calls him Clyde. And so I said, yeah, it was Rock and Steady. I said, well, how did you know that, Mr. President? And he said, I bought the book when I was 12 years old. And that gave me a kind of a laugh and kind of a little bit of a thrill, too, that the President of the United States had bought a book of mine when he was 12 years old in 1974. Spent the rest of the game essentially with some other people, talking to Obama. It was... he was just so relaxed. He had his two daughters with him. Michelle didn't come to the game. They had just come back from a trip to Hawaii, I believe. And so I had a chance to sit and, for almost nine innings, talk to the President of the United States. I mean, periodically others would come by. There was a senator from South Dakota came by. There was the owner of the... Nationals came by, meanwhile, it was an amazing opportunity to do that. And so, I didn't want to write about him right away because I was like a fly on the wall, and I was retired from the New York Times, and I just didn't feel comfortable writing about him then. As 2016 came around. And he was, going to be leaving the presidency after 8 years. I decided that I was going to write a piece, and I did. And it was for the NBC Sports website, and it's the first piece in my book. It's a fairly lengthy piece, but I'd like to think it's interesting, especially an insight to the President of the United States.
In the piece, you said he invited you to come visit him at the White House. Did you ever take him up on that?
No. He said Oh, I have told him that Rack and Steady was being reissued some 35 years after it was initially published. And he said, "Oh, I'd love to see the book." He said, "Well, you know, bring it when it's reissued. Come in and bring it to the White House." And I said, "I'd like to." I suggested that I'd bring it to the White House and have a Clive Frazier and I come in and give it to you. And he said, "Oh, that's a great idea. Look forward to it." But it never happened. I had known David Axelrod from Chicago. Axelrod was his advisor for a couple of years, a senior advisor in the White House, and who had been a Chicago Tribune reporter. And I had a relationship with Axelrod, and so it was Axelrod who invited me to the White House, but the president wasn't there at that time. So I've never seen the president face to face again, but I did give Axelrod the new Rock and Steady, he gave it to Obama, and I never heard from him since.
So in the book, there are two pieces that I thought were particularly interesting. You had a piece on Pete Rose, and you had a piece on Billy Martin. And in these two pieces, one thing I noticed is that they would say things that you believed were untrue, and you would quote them, and you would tell the background and paint them to have said something that was not accurate or not true, but you would do it in a way where you didn't name call them as a liar. Is that kind of a specific skill that you picked up over the years, or like when you're in the writing process, how do you go about tackling those positions?
Well, when I'm interviewing somebody, and if somebody says something that is seemingly not true, or I know not to be true, I'll come in on sideways. You don't want to end the interview. It all depends on when you're asking this question. Jimmy Cannon, the great sports writer, New York sports writer, once said that you ask the hard question last because you don't want to go back to the office with an empty notebook. Yeah. So you ask. I don't recall, as we're talking, the two incidents that you met, instances that you mentioned. But I can understand what they are. What I try to do is, if somebody says that the sky is black when the sky is blue, he'll say the sky is black, and I may ask him something else, and then something else, and then come back to it in a different way. What color black was the sky, or something like that, to depict another view, and that they're going to have to defend that. Do it in a way that isn't confrontational, or try not to be confrontational. So that's how I try to operate.
Another piece that I thought was interesting involved Marge Schott. So I'm 30 years old, and I only remember the time where she's been a pariah. But one of the things you mentioned in the piece is that she was actually pretty relatively beloved, both as like a pioneer and an eccentric, before depositions came out that painted her as having used racial slurs. What was it like when she was kind of a beloved figure in Americana?
Well, I don't know altogether about beloved. She was always viewed as an eccentric. And around Cincinnati, she was owned of the Cincinnati Reds. And around Cincinnati, she did a lot of charitable work. And so, there were people who loved her or had a high opinion of her, and she was the owner of the team when they went to the World Series with Lou Piniella was the manager, so they had some good teams. But she alienated a lot of people. I was with her doing a story with her, and I depicted her as being kind of a rude or crude a woman. And at one moment, we were driving in a car in Cincinnati, and there was a sign. There was a local election coming up, and one of the running for councilman, as I believe it was somebody named Goering. And of course, Goering was a famous Nazi. He was one of the important Nazis, Hermann Goering. And but now this was someone named Goering who was a citizen of Cincinnati, and I pointed out the name Goering and mentioned about the Nazis, and she said to me that she had relatives in Germany and during the war, and it was very hard on them. And she said, "Well, you know, Hitler was good in the beginning, but he went too far." And I decided not to challenge her on that. By too far, I would have said, I thought to myself, what's too far? 2 million Jews, 3 million Jews killed, 4 million Jews. So I decided not to say that, but I did write it. And then I wrote also something. I went to her home, and in a drawer, she had a Christmas decorations and a Nazi flag. Someone had given her a Nazi flag as a souvenir, and she said, I just kept it with my same drawers, their Christmas decorations. And so I just noted this without saying anything. But when I wrote the piece, I wrote this juxtaposition of the Nazi flag and the Christmas decorations. And I also wrote that she had said that Hitler was good in the beginning but went too far. And when she was suspended from baseball, these were two of the elements that Bud Selig used to suspend her from baseball. And so now she's going to be suspended. It was over the winter. And so now at spring training, I went to the Reds spring training camp in Plant City, Florida. And she had come there to say goodbye to her team before the suspension. And I saw her, and I said, Marge, Ira Burko, I introduced myself again, thinking that she may not have remembered me. And she said, I remember you. I invited you into my home, and you broke my heart. And, you know, you try to be an objective reporter, columnist, writer, and I thought that I did the correct thing in depicting her as she was. But still in all, it was a little bit of a knife in my heart, you know, to say that I broke her heart. I didn't want to hurt her, but my obligation was first to my readers and not to her.
And that's juxtaposed with Billy Martin, who you wrote an equal, I don't know about equally, but it certainly wasn't a flattering portrayal of him. But when you went into the Yankees locker room, he was like, oh, tough but fair.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting that the executive editor of the New York Times, Abe Rosenthal, called me in the office and said, Ira, it's Billy Martin. He keeps getting into fights with people, and he keeps getting into different kinds of problems. And I understand that he's a drunk and that he has a drinking problem, and this leads to his getting into confrontations and brawls. And he said, I'd like you to do a story on him and just talk about some of the drinking and stuff, and if this is so. And I said, Dave Rosenthal, I said, this is going to be difficult, you know, I mean, but I'll, essentially I was saying, you're the boss, and I'll try. And so I went to Martin, and he knew me, I'd been around, and I went to the manager's office. And so I said, Billy, when you're on the road, what do you do for relaxation? I think I phrased it something like that. And he said, well, you know, on the road, when I go to Minneapolis, I go to Charlie's, restaurant and go to the bar and drink there. And then when I go to St. Louis, I go to this bar. And so he started depicting these bars and these and his essentially his life of boozing. So I wrote the piece, and then I decided that I'm not going to avoid him or the Yankees. And when the piece came out, maybe that day or the day after, I made sure that I was in a place in the Yankee clubhouse that I would be seen. And I didn't go into Martin's office, because then that would have been sort of confrontational, I thought. But I was nearby his office, and that when he came out, he would surely see me. And so I stood around, and then eventually he came out of his office, and he did see me, and he said to me, "Tough but fair." And interestingly enough, it's exactly the phrase that Trump used when I did a piece on Trump and depicting Trump and all his egotism. But some of his positive points. And he called me at the New York Times, and he said about the piece, he also said, "Tough but fair." So I don't know if these two guys hung out together, Martin and Trump, hung out together and compared notes. But the pieces were done a few years apart. The one piece I did on, in this particular one on Trump, because I did a few pieces on him, because he was involved with boxing, and I covered that, and he was also had ownership of the short-lived United States Football League. He owned the New Jersey team, and so I got to know Trump, and I got to know Billy Martin, and you know, I thought I wrote about them in an objective way, as they say, warts and all.
Could you have conceived ever, until it happened, that Trump could become president of the United States?
Never, ever, ever. On the other hand. When George W. Bush was running for the presidency in 2000, and he was kind of viewed as either immature or a bit of an eccentric managing partner of the Texas Rangers, and I'd heard stories about other team owners viewing him in less than complimentary terms. And so the Yankees were playing the World Series in 2000. I was behind the batting cage, and there were a bunch of people around, and I saw Bud Selig, who I knew. And I went over to Selig, and I said, "Bud," he was commissioner of baseball at the time and former owner of the Milwaukee Brewers, and so he had a lot of dealings with George W. And I said, "Bud, could you ever have imagined that George W. Bush could be president of the United States?" It was 1 month to go before the election, and it was a year before, and so he looked around to make sure nobody was in earshot. And he whispered, and when I said to him, "Do you ever believe that George W. could ever be president of the United States?" And he looked around, and he whispered to me, "No, never." And I felt the same way about Trump. He could say some even then he could say some outrageous things, even about women. You know, now he's being criticized. Some of the things he said about women, and I was with him at the time that Clinton in the late 90s, and Clinton was now in the news with having a sexual relationship with Monica Lewinsky. And he said, and Trump said to me, I don't think he was married to Marla Maples at the time, or he was between marriages. But he said to me, I don't understand Clinton. He goes with such dogs, such pigs. He says, I date models. I go with actresses, beautiful women. I don't know why he goes with these ugly women. And I was, I mean, he's still a public figure, and he was saying these things. And I didn't write that. I just felt, now if he's running for president and he says that, I write that. But at the time, there was no point in it, and he was a sports figure. I depicted other elements of his mindset, but not that. And he's a charming guy in a lot of ways. And he did he read enough newspapers, or I guess he just read stuff about himself. He was very knowledgeable about sports. Very knowledgeable about sports, and I think he's a pretty good athlete. Now I understand. He's a good golfer apparently, but people say that he cheats. So a lot of people don't like to play with him, and I've heard that from a number of sources.
Switching gears a bit, so. Was there a specific story that someone at the New York Times noticed that got you launched there, or was it like a collective body of work? How did you get to the New York Times originally?
How I got to the New York Times? Well, I went to Miami of Ohio undergraduate school, and I met a guy named David Bergen, who was on the school paper, who I was going to be a lawyer, and he lived across the dormitory from me, I was an English major, and I was interested in sports and played sports, and so he said, why don't you try writing on the school paper, which I did, and I fell in love with it, and then I went to Northwestern graduate school, then I went from there I got my job at the Minneapolis Tribune. I was there 2 years, and Bergen had gone to Newspaper Enterprise Association, which was a Scripps Howard syndicate and went out to 750 papers. And he worked on the staff there with a man named Sandy Padway. So Sandy Padway left to go to the Philadelphia Inquirer, and they left an opening. Dave Bergen told the sports editor, Murray Olderman, about me working at the Minneapolis Tribune, and Murray Olderman called and hired me, and I got to Newspaper Enterprise Association, and because Sandy Padway left, created an opening, and Padway and I got to meet each other, and we became friends. Padway eventually became the deputy sports editor of the New York Times, and when Red Smith was getting ill, Red Smith, the great sports columnist, was at the New York Times, and he was getting ill. One day Sandy Padway called me as deputy sports editor and said, we don't know how long Red's going to continue. This was at the end of 1980. We don't know how much longer Red's going to continue, and we're looking to eventually replace him. And also, we'd like a feature writer at the same time, and we'd like to hire you. And so at I took this as a good opportunity.
How old were you at this time?
Pardon me?
How old were you at this time?
40 in December 1980, and then in January I turned 41. Okay. And I had had a relationship.
This a while.
Pardon me?
You'd been writing for a while now.
I've been writing professionally since 1965 at the Minneapolis Tribune,
uh-huh.
to 67, and then on to Newspaper Enterprise Association, NEA. And then I left NEA to do freelancing and to do some books, and I was from 76 to when I joined the Times, I wasn't employed by a any newspaper or any periodical. And so and I joined the Times, and I had had a relationship with Red Smith because I wrote him when I was in college, writing a column for the school paper at Miami of Ohio. And he wrote me back, and we developed the correspondence. And I certainly didn't want to replace Red Smith, and but an opportunity to write a column alongside Red Smith was very appealing to me. And so anyway, I took the job, and in January of 1982, I got a call from the sports editor, Joe Vecchione, and he said, we've got bad news that Red Smith died, and we want you to write the obituary. And so I was ambivalent about this, because Red had become, I was friendly with Red, and he was a mentor to me. Now I have to do it, write his obituary, and I knew Red's life, I had studied him. And so I wrote the obituary, and it turned out that it was the January of 1982, and it was made the front page of the New York Times, Under the Fold. And it was my first A1 story in the New York Times. And I was sorry that it had to be on Red Smith's death. But also, I was comforted by the fact that I felt I knew Red as well as anybody, and that, you know, in the best of all possible worlds, I could do justice to his obituary. And I guess the New York Times felt the same way because they put it on the front page.
You did a podcast, not a podcast, you did Jeremy Schapp's radio show about a month or two back, and the two of you were lamenting that that the newspaper columnist is kind of a dying art. And I'd agree with you that in the sense of like the New York Times or Washington Post or any of these people having, any of these papers having essential columnists that everybody has to read, I think those days are nearing an end. But there are columnists out there online and even in different mediums like television and radio that if you like really know where to seek them out, I think it's like an evolution of the position. For example, like Dan Le Batard, 30 years ago, his column at the Miami Herald, he would have just been there for 50 years. But now, like, to get a Le Batard column, you have to watch him on television or listen to him on the radio. And it's a little different than, it's a lot different than writing. But I do think that the position exists. It's just all over the place. Would you agree with that or no?
Yes, I would agree with it. I'm not one to go searching blogs. And I'm still a newspaper reader and a magazine reader. I liked the fact that you could read a columnist two or three or four times a week in a newspaper. And they become like part of your life where you can kind of read them and disagreeing with them. You know, like, for example, if we go away from the sports columns just for a moment, but I know that every Saturday in the Wall Street Journal, which I don't agree with the Wall Street Journal's politics altogether, but Peggy Noonan every Saturday has a reasoned voice, I think. And I know that every Saturday I can count on reading Peggy Noonan. In the New York Times now every Sunday there's Maureen Dowd. But also on the op-ed page of the New York Times, there's Christoph twice a week, or Gail Collins, who I love, who's funny, is twice a week. But you don't have that in sports for some reason. The sports column in the New York Times, they don't have that. It's just every once in a while you'll read, they have two sports columnists now, or it says sports at the Times. Juliet Macker and Michael Powell, both very good writers. But they write periodically. I mean, maybe once every two or three weeks you'll see their column. And so they don't become a part of your life, really. They don't become like Red Smith or Jimmy Cannon, or maybe even like, Well, Washington Post. I don't know how often Tom Boswell writes anymore, or Sally Jenkins, but I think them even more frequently than the Times guys. But around the country, I guess the Los Angeles Times, which I don't get, but like Plaschke is a terrific columnist. I don't know how often he writes, but that was newspapering
Boswell write pretty frequently still.
Who Boswell does?
Boswell, yeah. And Jenkins both write pretty frequently.
Yeah, and Tillander in Chicago at the Sun-Times. You know, so, I mean, these are, is this old world or old school kind of stuff? But no, you pick up the Sun-Times and you want to see what Rick has to say. You know, every once in a while you pick up, the New York Times and, oh, here's Michael Powell, but... He's just, it's not a regular thing, and I don't know why. Well, yes, I do. The New York Times, for example, the sports department had thought that what we want is insight, is really in-depth stuff. So they have columns called On Baseball. The baseball writer is On Baseball, the national columnist, they have On Basketball, Harvey Arrington, which all good stuff, but it's not like a general columnist. And it's what I did, and I miss that because I grew up with that, and that kind of thing doesn't exist anymore. You mentioned Le Batard, and I'm not a digital guy, and so I don't go looking for that kind of stuff. Now, Frank DeFord, who just passed away, who was a great magazine writer, also was good on NPR. And so, you turn on NPR and regularly you knew when to get Frank DeFord. I miss that, but I miss it in the newspapers. I just do. That's what I've always looked forward to. And growing up, I grew up in Chicago, and we had the columnists, and one was John Carmichael, who almost nobody remembers anymore, but he had a column called The Barbershop. It was like you go into a barbershop and you have conversations and opinions with people, and that's what the column should be. And I'll just repeat myself, that's the kind of thing that I miss.
Yeah, no, I can definitely understand that. And like you said, it doesn't really exist in the newspaper, but there are a lot of web columnists that I enjoy that I guess it's a totally different world because you're not picking it up and physically reading it, but like Twitter can just branch you out. There are a lot of bad parts about Twitter, but a good part is like if Dan Wetzel at Yahoo, who's a very good national columnist along the lines of like the position you're describing, he covers NFL, he covers college football, he covers a lot of different things, and he's a generalist, but like Twitter will get like the second that he files his column, you can read it, and it's not going to be on a regular day, it could be at 2 in the morning after the college football national championship game, or it could be pertaining to any sort of like breaking news or trial or anything like that. But there are these people out there. It's just, they're not put in front of you, delivered to your doorstep.
Right. Well, here is something else that I liked about the great columnists, if we're talking about that, and is that they had a sense of poetry, that there was a beauty in their language, and an impact in their expression, and that's what struck me with the great columnists. And so now you get firing the manager columns, and you get strong opinions, which are fine. But also, I liked the beauty of language that just for me. And I started reading Rhett Smith, for example, who was syndicated columnist, and I started reading him in the Chicago Sun-Times, where he was syndicated. At when I was in last part of my high school and college days. And when I went to Miami of Ohio, he was also syndicated in the Dayton Daily News and the Cincinnati Inquirer, which were both about 35 miles away from Oxford, Ohio, where I went to school. And but I would read Red, and I would be moved by Red. He could make you laugh, and he could bring you he could write something so poignant he could nearly bring you to tears. Then he could write something so erudite, almost like a beautifully written legal treatise. That's the kind of thing that I still look for. I get that, for example, just off the top of my head, but I get that from Boswell and Sally Jenkins, both. And also the two columnists at the New York Times, Powell and Macker. Those are the kinds of things I look for. I'd like to mull over a nice phrase, a turn of phrase. It's a more leisurely, kind of reading, and I guess maybe less neurotic. And those are the kinds of things that have brought pleasure to me, and still do on a more and more limited basis.
That's a fair point. So let's get out of here on this. Describe your feelings when the Chicago Cubs finally won the World Series in Cleveland this past November. I was actually at Game 7. What were your impressions of that as like a lifelong baseball follower who grew up in Chicago?
Well, I grew up as a Cub fan, and my neighborhood was Cub fans. First on the west side of Chicago, and then on the north side of Chicago, in Chicago. Meet a lot of people, they say they're from Chicago, but they're actually from Barrington or Winnetka or something. But I was from the city. And going to the ball games, both Comiskey Park and Wrigley Field, and actually when I was younger, we would sneak into games. We'd find ways to sneak into games, find ways to sneak down to the box seats, get thrown out of one area of the box seats, go into another area of the box seats. But I followed the Cubs, all my life, and especially, going to games when they would draw, 6,000 people or something. And some of the jokes we used to have, how'd the Cubs do? The Cubs won. Yeah, Philly 6. It was 6-1. So, so this was the Cubs, and they generally end up in last place or next to last place. But that now they had this outstanding team, and in 2016 and 2015, they had also a very good team, but they got swept by the Mets in the playoffs. But now they're a juggernaut, and they go into the World Series, and they fall behind in the World Series, the first two games were in Los Angeles. They're playing in the playoffs. The first two games now were in Cleveland in the World Series, and I got tickets to go to the World Series in Wrigley Field, which was a moving experience. But the crowds were fantastic, and it was very crowded. It was very difficult to get around, The Cubs lost their first two games I was at, and then I gave my tickets to relatives of mine for the third game in Wrigley Field. Then I came home and then watched the seventh game, and it was such an incredible, incredible game. And then there was the rainout after nine innings, going into extra innings, it was just like Hollywood couldn't have done this any better. And then the Cubs won, and my wife said that my eyes were a little moist. She might have been right. But it was after all these years. I mean, following the Cubs from 1948, when I was 8 years old, to now 2016, it was a long, long journey. And then afterward, I was home, and after the World Series, I ran into a neighbor, and And he said, you know, it's very hard to repeat. He said, who cares about repeating? Who cares? You know, I mean, after what they did and how that season was, you know, it's something that you could take to your grave and with a smile on your face. Now, you know, as we speak, they're having a lackluster season, and I follow them, but you know, if they don't do well, it's still okay, you know. But you do, as a Cub fan, still you like to see them do well.
Is there anything we didn't talk about that you think is like very, very interesting or compelling or important that we like that you want to like use this platform to discuss right now?
Well, one thing is Pete Rose, and when I you know, give a talk someplace or have a I do a course at I did a course at Florida Atlantic University and now at Drew University in New Jersey on sports and society. I conduct a class and always the first question is about Pete Rose. Is he going to get in the Hall of Fame? And I was always for Pete Rose to get in the Hall of Fame. I didn't think the Hall of Fame should be a place for Boy Scouts necessarily. And if you go through, you know, people who are in the Hall of Fame now and who did drugs and who were racists or who had problems with spousal abuse, you're gonna get a limited. Those plaques are gonna start coming off the walls at the Hall of Fame. Pete Rose was called Charlie Hustle for a very good reason, because he broke his butt, you know, hustling and playing. And I mean, he holds a record that I think will never be broken. I don't mean just the hits record, which he holds most hits in a career, but he started at five different positions in All-Star games. He started first base, second base, third base, left field, and right field, which is just phenomenal. Shows his versatility, shows his drive. Now, he gambled on baseball. It's true. And there's a question about when he was managing, did he, you know, fool around with the rotation or but there's never any his pitching rotation. But there was never any evidence that he threw any games. But he did bet on baseball, which is against the rules of baseball. It probably wouldn't be nearly as big a sin if it hadn't been for the 1919 Black Sox. If it hadn't been for that, which almost ruined baseball, and Babe Ruth really almost saved baseball with his home runs. If not for that, it might just, you bet on baseball, you just get a suspension, probably, you know. But now it's just a cardinal sin, and Rose did it. Rose is flawed. But I think that his achievements in the game were so phenomenal that there should be a plaque up and saying he was the hit king, but he also bet on baseball, broke a cardinal rule. The Hall of Fame should be for what you did on the field. And I guess the same thing could be said for Shoeless Joe Jackson, who still has the third highest batting average of all time, and who did in the 1919 World Series. He, even though he had a high batting average, he admitted to not chasing balls the way he should, and in the outfield, and also in some games not hitting the way he should, and he also took money from the gamblers. The great, great players, Shoeless Joe Jackson, Pete Rose, are two of the greatest players in the history of the game, and for various reasons, beyond their flaws. It's hard to write a history of baseball without depicting their achievements. So the Hall of Fame should have plaques for both of them, with addendums saying what their flaws were. And so that's about all I have to say, Ryan.
Thank you so much, Ira. I really appreciate your time. I feel like we could talk about various topics all day. Definitely hope to do this again at some point, and have a great rest of the week. Thank you again for coming on.
Okay, Ryan. Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye, Ira.
Turn strange.